Hello, Gallatin Valley and southwestern Montana. Hope you're doing well. This program today is called Health and Happiness, and it is designed to help you understand more about yourself and those around you, so we all seek a greater degree of health and happiness, not only for ourselves, but for those around us. I'm Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist and chair of the Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association. My co-host is Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist, who introduces our show now on KGVM 95.9 FM or KGVM.org.
Being in the military is not easy. Away from family, enduring stringent training, sleeping on a bunk with others all around you, learning how to inflict harm on enemies, it's not an easy segue from civilian life. And then, for many, living through the realities of war. Today we have a veteran to share with us some of these realities and the impacts of lasting import. We'd like to welcome Josh Spillers. We appreciate your service on our behalf, Josh, and we're also proud to hear that you are going to graduate soon from the MSU Counseling Program, another segue of great importance. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, thank you.
We're just going to maybe start with back in your earlier history. What prompted you to decide to join the military, Josh?
So joining the military was kind of something that was like always known for me. My family, there's deep historical roots of military service in my family. My mom's dad, my grandfather, he served in the Army during Vietnam. And I have many cousins who served in the late 90s and early 2000s that were in when 9/11 happened. And then various aunts and uncles who served in the Gulf War in the early 90s and things like that. And so it was just something that I kind of always knew I wanted to do because I was always influenced by those members of the family. And when I was in eighth grade, I joined the junior ROTC program called the Young Marines. And I was actually in the Young Marines when 9/11 happened. And that was kind of the defining moment that made me decide that I wanted to join the Marine Corps as opposed to any of the other branches.
Wow, that was a time, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Just FYI, we had a daughter in New York City who looked up and saw that event happen. She had just gone to college and was a freshman from Oklahoma, right downtown New York. So,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, so we were very close up and up front with that. And so that was also a big, major impact for your thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then as you made it through high school and ROTC, I imagine you were still pretty active with thinking thoughts of the military.
Yeah, so I attended the Young Marine program when I was in, when my family still lived in California. When I was 13, my dad had moved my brother and I to Wyoming, to the eastern side of the state of Wyoming. And I remember having a conversation with him when we left town from California. I was like, I know when I turn 18, I want to join the Marine Corps. And, he said, okay. And we moved to Wyoming, lived there for about a year, and then moved to to Oregon, to the Oregon coast. And while attending high school in Oregon, during this time I had not been in the Young Marines anymore because there were not Young Marine chapters in Wyoming or in Oregon where I lived. And so I had dropped out of ROTC during that time period. When I went to Oregon, I saw a gentleman in my math class one day who was wearing a Air Force type uniform. And his ribbon rack, something had caught his ribbon rack and had popped one of his ribbons off of his ribbon rack. And I happened to see it and I got his attention and said, hey man, hey, your ribbon's messed up. And he's like, oh, thanks. And so he fixed it. And then he caught me after class. He's like, hey, not many people know about, you know, like that type of stuff. He's like, but you caught my ribbon rack. He's like, why is that? And I was like, well, I used to be in the Marines back in the eighth grade. And I know, like, you know, uniform regulation and stuff like that. He's like, well, I'm in the Civil Air Patrol. And have you ever thought about joining that? And I said, I had never even heard of it. And so I did the Civil Air Patrol for about a year in high school. I want to say that was like during my late freshman, early sophomore year of high school. But by the time I was like 15 years old, I was already in my recruiter's office trying to like sign the papers because I was like ready to go. I knew that's what I was doing. And my recruiter was like, hey, you need to come back when you're like 16, 17 years old because we can't legally sign you up right now.
That's amazing. It was just such a total surround for you that military was your future. I think, too, for a lot of young people, thinking that when I come out, I will have full educational support as well. Was that a factor for you, Josh?
Absolutely. I came from a family that we weren't super poor growing up, especially when my mom and dad were still married. We weren't well off by any means, but we also weren't like completely broke. I would say for the 90s, we were a pretty average, like middle class family. When my mom and dad had split up and divorced and we went into high school, it became pretty apparent to me that like I was not going to be able to go to college on any sort of money that my parents had because they didn't have any money at that time. And I had to make a decision that if I wanted to go to college, that I would have to figure out a way to do it. And I knew that the military would offer educational benefits. So that certainly was a small factor in why I wanted to join as well.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So tell us the next part when you actually graduated from high school.
Yes. So I graduated a little bit early, not because of my own amazing academic abilities, but because I had to join a program in order to make sure I graduated on time because I was behind in classes. Had I not joined that program, I wouldn't have joined on time and I wouldn't have been able to leave for boot camp when I wanted to. I ended up finishing about 2 months early, and so I decided to talk to my recruiter and said, hey, can I leave for boot camp early? And so I actually ended up going to boot camp when I was 17. I turned 18 in boot camp, and that was kind of the natural progression there. I went to boot camp right out of high school and didn't miss a beat between that transition between high school and military service.
Wow, that sounds like such a total change in your life.
Yeah, so that was a really big change for me. I remember getting the call one morning. I'd been trying to leave early, and I got a call probably about like 8 or 9 in the morning from my recruiter who said, hey, did you still want to jump out or go out to boot camp early? And I said, yeah, absolutely. Were you able to get me that ship date that I was looking at? And he said, nope. And I said, okay, so when are you thinking I'm leaving? He said, today. And I had to wake my dad up and have a conversation with him and called my mom, who was still living in California, and had a conversation with her and decided, you know what, now's a better time than never to just get out of this town. The town I lived in wasn't a lot going on in my town growing up in high school. And so I was really looking to get out of there. And so that day on April 16th of 2006, my dad dropped me off at my recruiter's office and I went to Portland, Oregon. And next thing I know, I was on a plane to San Diego. And by that weekend, I had started Marine Corps boot camp.
That's incredible. It just seems amazing. Such a total change of everything around you and everything you'd been doing. Tell us more what happened.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's definitely a shock. You know, I was not a big sports guy in high school, so I didn't really play organized sports in high school. I was a skateboarder. I played guitar. Smoked my fair share of marijuana when I was in high school, and just kind of ran with that crowd in high school. It was kind of a laid back kind of a person, and I got to NCRD San Diego and got picked up at the airport with a group of young men who were going to boot camp at the time. And I remember getting on the bus, and you know, they tell you to put your head down, and they drive you over to the depot, and drill instructors come onto the bus and start screaming and yelling and tell you to get off the bus, and all, you know, it's just chaos ensues, right? And so that was my first exposure to, oh, this is the decision that I made. This is the decision that I now have to live with, is this radical change in lifestyle. And so for the next 2 days, you get no sleep, and they do the moment of truth and make sure you didn't lie about anything on your application and things like that. And then Black Friday happens, which is where you get picked up by your platoon that you're going to be training with for the next 3 months. And you know, Black Friday is a very surreal moment. If there's any other military veterans or Marine Corps veterans specifically that are listening to this interview on your guys' radio show, they're going to know exactly what I'm talking about, because that moment in life is a very, very life-changing moment, and it's a very high realization moment for a lot of people. And I remember Black Friday happened, and I remember getting online, and drill instructors were running all over our squad bay, and they're throwing things around, and they're screaming and yelling in people's faces. And I just remember thinking in that moment, like, I think I made the wrong decision. What was I thinking? Why did I want to do this?
Yeah.
But that experience instilled a lot of resiliency in me. It also helped me understand that had a lot of inherent resiliency in me that I didn't know that I had. I went through a lot of things when I was young. I went through, you know, being sexually molested for several years. That was part of what led my dad to move my brother and I to Wyoming, was that happening. And I didn't know that I could handle something like that. And so being able to go through that, put myself through that, like, extreme stress for 3 months straight and find out the kind of person that I actually was a really great experience, and was a much needed experience in my life. And I think it set me up for a lot of success, you know, later on down the road, you know, up to and including, you know, now at almost 38 years old.
Could I just ask, what was the moment of truth, and define Black Friday? What happens during those events?
Yeah, so the moment of truth is kind of this weird moment when you first get to boot camp. You're in the receiving phase of boot camp. And what it is you've gone through some pretty extreme moments of sleep deprivation. They've kept you up for roughly about 48 hours straight. You've gotten your hair cut. They've been screaming and yelling at you. You are exhausted beyond all compare. And essentially what happens is they come in and they just say, hey, we just need to know if there's anything that you didn't happen to mention to your recruiter when you were enlisting, we just need you to let us know about that right now so we can get that added to your record or get it taken care of or get it addressed. What they're trying to do is they're trying to catch recruits that lied and falsified their documents to get into boot camp. I don't know if they still do that, because there's a whole new system that the military uses for enlistments that is much more thorough about being able to find stuff in people's records and in their past than there was like when I was joining. But that's basically all it is. They're just trying to find inconsistencies with your enlistment documents, things like that. Some little things aren't like a big deal. They'll get it added in and then you just move on with your training. But sometimes, you know, recruits will lie about, you know, like medical things, like they're able to hide that they had asthma, or at the time were able to hide that they had asthma, or something along those lines. And if it gets caught, then it can actually get you sent home because it could be a potential issue while doing training. Or if you had any legal issues that popped up that you failed to tell your recruiter that were still in like pending stages, so your recruiter didn't see anything like on any official documentation, there were recruits that had stuff like that going on. And so then that came up because warrants or subpoenas or something came out. And so they would get sent home. They would get in trouble for that. That's kind of what the moment of truth is, just to make sure that none of the recruits lied about anything that they were doing or had going on. And then Black Friday is the day that you meet with your drill instructors for the first time.
Wow.
So what they do is you wake up Friday morning, you get ready to go to sleep Thursday night. Your receiving drill instructors kind of tell you, you know, they kind of have a moment with you where it's a little bit laid back for a minute, where they're kind of offering you an opportunity to ask questions about like what training is going to be like, and what to expect, and you know, advice on how to act and react to certain things. And they give you a list of like, okay, you know, they call out your name and they say, okay, so you're going to this platoon, you're going to this platoon, because there's usually, if I remember correctly, there, I believe there's about six platoons in a company at boot camp at any one given time. I think we had six platoons. We had lead series and follow series, and three platoons in each series. And so they say, oh, you know, recruit so-and-so, you're going to this platoon. So then you go to that, they take you over to those barracks the next morning, and the commanding officer and the series commander comes in. They do a little speech, a little spiel. Then they introduce your senior drill instructor, and then they give you over to your senior drill instructor. And there's a pretty famous speech that your senior drill instructor gives to you and the rest of the platoon, which you can actually find iterations of those speeches online. They're kind of pretty fun to watch sometimes, depending on who the senior drill instructor is that's giving them. But he basically starts with, sit up straight and listen to me. And then he goes into the spiel of who he is, what they expect of you, who his drill instructors are. And then he'll turn around at the end of that speech and he'll say, drill instructors, take charge of these Marines, or take charge of these recruits and make them Marines. And he walks out of the room, and now you're left with what's called your green belt drill instructors. And it's just absolute chaos for about the next 24 hours. You're getting assigned your rack, you know, your bed, your foot locker, you're getting put online, you're getting sent to evening chow and all these different things. And then you got to go get uniform issue and stuff. But they pretty much just go absolutely crazy on you for about the next 24 hours. And they're screaming, they're yelling, they're doing all sorts of craziness. And it's just pure unadulterated chaos, from that moment on for about the next 3 months.
And so you're certain at this point this was a bad idea. You're 17 years old in the midst of this with no way out. Yeah.
Exactly. I remember sitting there thinking, like, maybe this wasn't what I was supposed to do with my life. Maybe I joined the wrong branch, or maybe I shouldn't have joined the military at all. But I was like, but I'm here now. I can't just be like, hey, I want to go home. You can't just raise your hand and be like, I quit. I mean, there are ways to get out of boot camp, but I certainly didn't want to be, you know, that person. I was like, I signed the dotted line. I kind of knew what I was getting into. I just didn't realize it was going to be quite so crazy. But I buckled down. I got my head set straight, and I pushed through, and it ended up being one of the best experiences of my life.
That's impressive. And so then you were commissioned as a soldier?
Yes. So MCRD, Marine Corps Recruit Depot, is for the enlisted Marines. And so when you graduate boot camp, typically you'll graduate as either a private or a private first class. On some rare occasions, you might graduate as a Lance Corporal, but those are pretty few and far between. It does happen, though. So I graduated as a private. I didn't have anything set up for me in my record or any extra things that I had done that could get me the extra promotion. So I graduated as a private and then was shipped off from MCRD San Diego, got to go home for 10 days, and then I went back to Camp Pendleton in California for my Marine combat training, and then attended Marine combat training at Camp Pendleton for 21 days, and then went from there over to Camp Johnson, North Carolina, which is where I attended school for my MLS, for my job. And then from there, got stationed at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, with Combat Logistics Regiment 27.
So 21 days of training for military actions, such as war, is that correct?
Yes, kind of. So there are two schools at the School of Infantry in California. Again, when I say there was or there is, I'm referring to the time frame of when I was in, because the Marine Corps changes their structure and the way they do things, like all that. They do it pretty regularly. So it could be,
okay,
if there's a younger Marine listening to this, they might be like, hey, wait a minute, what he's saying isn't how it is now. It very well may not be that way right now. This is just how it was when I was in. There was two schools. There was the School of Infantry, And then under the School of Infantry, there was two sections. There was Marine Combat Training, or what is called MCT, and then there's ITB, which is Infantry Training Battalion. So if you were an infantry Marine, you would go to what's called ITB, and you would spend about 2 months there learning all things about it, about your job and being in the infantry. If you are a non-combat MLS, you would go to Marine Combat Training, which was like a condensed version of ITB, and basically what it was for, because they say that every Marine is a rifleman, every Marine is basically trained for rifleman. The idea is that any Marine can be a combat Marine if they need to be a combat Marine in any given situation if something happens. And so MCT is kind of this condensed version of ITB that's designed to help train the non-combat Marines and at least some basic operations of war fighting, but not in depth. So you don't become an expert. You just get like a general knowledge. So if you're in a situation where say some sort of like a combat action breaks out when you're deployed and you're like, I need to throw this grenade. Okay, well, I know how to throw the grenade because I went to MCT. And so you know how to properly arm a grenade and throw a grenade, but hopefully accurately, but know how to throw it in order to be able to be competent in the situation that you're in and not let your guys to the left and to the right of you, you know, die. You're hopefully competent enough that you can at least protect them or help protect them.
And so here you are, still 17. Have you turned 18 yet?
Yes. So I actually turned 18 almost exactly halfway through boot camp. I turned 18 right before we went to the rifle range in boot camp.
Okay. And so what happens next, Josh?
So you graduated MCT, or at least I graduated MCT, and then I found out that I was getting shipped off to Camp Johnson, North Carolina, to attend my MLS training for my job in the Marine Corps, which was 0481 Landing Support Specialist, which is a logistics track job. And so I got sent to Camp Johnson I got there like late August of 2006 and had to wait for a week or two to get picked up for my MLS school, which runs in 5 week cycles, and went to MLS school, graduated that in like October of 2006. So now I've been in the Marine Corps for roughly about 6 months or so before I got sent to the fleet. And then graduated the Basic Landing Support Specialist program and got sent just down the road to Camp Lejeune, about a 5 minute drive from Camp Johnson, and got stationed with what became my parent unit while I was in the Marine Corps, which was Combat Logistics Regiment 27. And then, that was kind of it. Life kind of normalized at that point once I got to the fleet, got introduced to some really stellar non-commissioned officers when I got there, several of whom I'm still in touch with to this day. They've become very good friends of mine. They're people who led me and mentored me as a young Marine. I attribute a lot of my successes in life to how they taught me and how they treated me and kind of raised me up in the Marine Corps, and have a lot of respect for those guys. And we went to Iraq together, went to Afghanistan together, and so I have a pretty deep relationship with them.
And tell us a little bit more about your job and why you ended up going to Iraq and Afghanistan.
Sure. So my job, like I said, was 0481 Landing Support Specialist. We were a logistics MLS, and basically there are five different areas of operations that we can end up in our MLS. It's a little bit different now. They just restructured it a couple of years ago, but back when I was in, it was rail operations, port operations, beach operations, so port and beach operations, working with like naval vessels, loading and unloading with cargo, passengers, and equipment. And then there was helicopter support teams, which was what we did a lot stateside. That's where the helicopters come in. They float above your head and you hook up really cool loads, really cool pieces of equipment to the underneath the helicopter, and the helicopter takes off with the load hanging underneath it. that was what our MLS was, or the biggest part of what our MLS was doing that type of operation. And then finally, aerial operation. And that was kind of where my area of expertise kind of landed in our MLS. Because when we went to Iraq in 2007, I went to Camp Fallujah. And this was a few years after all the craziness of Operation Phantom Fury occurred. But it was kind of calm. It wasn't as crazy. I remember being really freaked out getting ready to go over there, because a lot of my NCOs that I was serving under, they were over there during the time when it was wild and crazy and Operation Phantom Fury was happening. And so they were like, you know, get ready because it's kind of crazy over there and, you know, things might happen. And I remember being, you know, freaked out. I was just barely 19 at this point and was kind of freaking out a little bit about going. But then we got there and it was relatively calm. The base was built up. There wasn't a lot going on. And there wasn't a lot of craziness going on during that time. And so we just worked. I worked on LZ East at Camp Fallujah started out as the cargo non-commissioned officer in charge and during the daytime operations. And then I eventually went to nighttime operations and worked in the nighttime cycle. And in that position, we just kind of rotated through different positions. Worked with a lot of really cool celebrities, got to meet Chuck Norris while I was there, which was really, really cool. But we just worked with CH-53s the most often, and CH-47s, the Chinooks from the Army. Loading and unloading cargo and passengers on helicopters was our primary focus. And so that kind of set me up for this kind of basis in aerial operations. And so a year from when we got back from Iraq, so we got back from Iraq in March of 2008, in March of 2009 is when I shipped out to Camp Leatherneck in Afghanistan. And my sergeant, who was in charge of me in Iraq, Sergeant Housel, he had been promoted to staff sergeant by this point, and he was the one who was selected to be the acting officer in charge for our platoon detachment that was gonna go to Afghanistan. And he asked me to come along, I got voluntold to come along to Afghanistan with him to work on the Camp Leatherneck flight line, which was going to be working fixed wing operations with C-130s, C-17s, Russian IL-76s, and a handful of other fixed wing aircraft that would come in. He picked me and another Marine for our expertise in aerial logistics from being in Iraq. And he trusted us to get that job done. And so by this point, I was 20 years old, and I was a corporal of Marines, and I'd been a corporal for about not quite a year when I got shipped out to Afghanistan. And so when I got to Afghanistan, I was the non-commissioned officer in charge of the flight line at Camp Leatherneck. And now this is where my military experience shifted a lot. It shifted quite a lot, actually. This is where I got a more real experience of what war was like during my time in Afghanistan. And so we got there, and we did not know when we were going to come home. They did not give us a timeline. Typical Marine Corps deployments last 7 to 13 months, depending on if you were at a battalion level or a regimental level. And they told us they didn't know when they were going to be sending us home. So we get there, I get down to the flight line, I start setting it up, and we took that entire base, from about 3,000 Marines operationally up to about 15,000 Marines. And we did that in the course of about 2 months. We were there on the second largest flight line in the country, during the largest military operation since Vietnam, which was Operation Khanjar in Afghanistan. And this was in the early spring and summer of 2009 when this was occurring. And this deployment was nothing like Iraq. It was the operational workload was much higher and much more intense. Myself and my Marines were working on average 20 plus hours per day in rotation. So I would work for about 20 hours or so. I would sleep for about 3 or 4 and then get up and then work another, you know, anywhere from 18 up to about 20, 21 hours again. And I did that for about the first 2 to 3 months we were there. as well as my Marines. We worked very hard and we worked a very high workload and did not get a lot of sleep, and it was pretty intense. And then in July of that year was when Operation Condor kicked off. If I remember correctly, I believe that date was July 2nd of 2009. And that was when all hell broke loose for that deployment. That was when it got crazy. We sent a bunch of Marines down into the Southern Helmand Province, and there was a bunch of fighting. There was a lot of death and a lot of things like that. And so one of our duties on the flight line was not just dealing with cargo, passengers, and equipment, but was also dealing with the loss of our Marines and making sure that we were sending them home respectfully and ceremoniously to their families back in the States. So we dealt with a lot of fallen angel ceremonies while we were over there as well. And that had a pretty lasting impact on myself and some of my Marines while we were over there. So two very contrasting deployments that I went through.
And you were still just a very young person.
Yes.
Segueing through all of this. And I guess that sad reality of the brutality of war was now made insanely clear to you.
Yes. And so my experiences in Afghanistan were kind of, these moments of mental shifting for me, one, learning how to cope and deal with my own experiences and wrestle with that. When I came back from Afghanistan, I had about 4 months left in the Marine Corps before I was getting out, and I noticed that I was not the same. So at that point coming home, I noticed that I was having a lot of problems sleeping. I couldn't get to sleep at like a normal time. And when I would sleep, I would have really bad dreams about my experiences in Afghanistan and dealing with the fallen angels and things like that. And it was the best way I've always used to describe it, especially being like a student of psychology, is they make the analogy that our brains are very much so like computers. And the way I've always described it is, imagine when you are on your computer and you're on the internet and you're doing research or you're just looking at stuff and you keep opening new browser tab after new browser tab after new browser tab, rather than closing old ones and opening new ones or just using old ones to look up new things. You just keep opening browser tabs. Well, eventually you get to the point where your internet browser overloads on the amount of memory that it's using on the computer, and it causes your computer to freeze up and shut down. That was kind of how I described my brain coming back from Afghanistan. I had so much overload happen from all the different experiences and different operational tempos that I dealt with in Afghanistan that it just overloaded my brain, and my brain was trying to play catch up. But when you're still in the military, you don't have that opportunity for your brain to recuperate and recover in those situations. You just have to go right back into it. And so my brain never did catch up, at least in those last 4 months that I was in. And it ended up leading to some small disciplinary problems with my squad leader. I finally had to pull him aside one day with a couple of the staff NCOs that I had served with while I was in Afghanistan, and have I kind of forced him to have this heart-to-heart with me of like, hey, I need you to understand, like, this is not the type of Marine I am. I don't know what's going on. I'm also getting out in 4 months, so like I would really appreciate if you don't pursue any sort of like non-judicial punishment action towards me or anything like that, because I know that while technically you have every right to, all you're going to do is screw up my ability to pursue things after I get out. This is not who I normally am. I don't know what's going on, but I can't really get any help for it until after I get home anyways. And so I really prefer you not to do anything that can mess with like my VA benefits or anything like that. They could potentially harm my ability to get the help that I need. And so he didn't like it, but he agreed to it. And I think part of that was because I had those two staff NCOs with me in that meeting who were able to kind of back me up and support me in that and say, yes, like we're telling you, like we've known him his entire military career. This is definitely not the type of Marine that he is. Like, let's, he's getting out, and like at this point I have like maybe 2 months left. They're like, there's all you're gonna do is hurt him if you do anything. And so he kind of backed off a little bit, I was able to kind of get myself put together enough to where I was able to start showing up on time to formations again in the morning, which was really good. But with that went a lack of sleep. A lot of times I would have nights where, because I was already having trouble sleeping at all, if I got past a certain point at night, I just wouldn't sleep at all. And I would just get up and go to a PT formation and go to work and just do my things with no sleep.
You know, I wanted to take a moment and tell you about another veteran we had on this radio show, Josh. And it was years after he'd been in the military. And his sleep was so badly disrupted by the dreams that you're describing. He'd been in Afghanistan and those same places. And he went to the VA doctors and they said, this is so severe that when you have these terrible traumatic dreams, it's releasing toxic chemicals of stress, cortisol. And it could shortly impact your heart function as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's life-threatening at this point. You have to do something about it. And they gave him, this is so unique, a therapy dog that had been trained to observe veterans sleeping. And if they had rapid eye movement, which indicates they're having dreaming, the dog would wake the veteran up. And this veteran was totally helped by this therapy dog who went with him everywhere and slept with him and prevented those terrible releases of toxins into his heart. Just think what you're talking about is so real for so many veterans. And I want to point out there's help for this. And so keep going. You're now 2 months away from release.
Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So the 2 months, last couple months I was in kind of went by uneventfully, other than just I had the inherent struggle of, you know, as I got closer and closer to my end of service date, I struggled with, you know, am I making the right decision by getting out and going home or should I stay in? So I get out, I go home, and I quickly have the realization about 6 months after getting home that now on the flip side of everything, I've now made the mistake of getting out of the military instead of staying in. And I deeply regretted that decision, and I did for a long time. The truth is, I've had a lot of experiences in life as a veteran civilian that have led me to be the person that I am today and has allowed me to be a really strong resource for my friends who decided to stay in. 2 years ago, my friend, so Housel, Sergeant Housel that I referred to earlier, just retired. I think about two and a half years ago now as a Master Gunnery Sergeant in the Marine Corps. And I'm still in touch with him. I still talk to him regularly. In fact, he helped write my letter of recommendation for my getting into the honors program at MSU. And he also just wrote my letter of recommendation for me to hopefully get into the Master's of Science in Mental Health Counseling also at MSU. And I'm in touch with him all the time. And I just had a really good friend of mine who I went up through the Marine Corps with, just retired back in December. And that was a very surreal, hard moment for me because him and I went up through the Marine Corps together. And so sitting at his retirement ceremony was a little bit hard because I was having that realization that, had I stayed in, I would be kind of going out right along with him, or at least be eligible for going out right along with him at this point. And so that was a little bit hard, but like I've told them, I said, I've been out for 16 years now. The problems that you're going to encounter with the Veterans Affairs Department, the problems you're going to encounter if you decide to go to school using your VA home loan, all of these things you're going to run into problems with. And you're going to get frustrated. You're going to get discouraged. You're going to want to quit. I said, because I can promise you all the things you'll deal with now are probably harder than any of the things we actually dealt with while we were in the military, or at least it seems like it. But the cool thing is now you actually have a resource that is at your fingertips that has figured out most of the answers to those problems by now in the last 16 years that I've been out. And so you guys aren't alone. And now where you guys were there for me when I was in as a young Marine, now I can be here for you as you guys are transitioning back to becoming civilians again. And, you know, so don't hesitate to text me. Don't hesitate to call me or ask me anything. I said, and just like I was when I was in the Marine Corps, I may not have the answer. I may not know the answer or have the answer right then and there, but you guys know that my ability to find the answer is second to none. That is one of my very few skill sets, is I'm very good at finding things. And I can get you an answer if you have a question that I don't have an answer to. And I said, so it's been nice because, you know, now they're messaging me every once in a while saying, hey, what about this or what about that? And I'm able to help them in a way that they were able to help me back then. And so that's kind of given me, in the last couple of years, I've kind of found this new purpose of being able to be there for veterans. It's led to the formation of my new nonprofit that we're working on right now with a couple of my colleagues and things like that. And so that's kind of where we're at right now, is just, you know, finally, after 16 years of being out, finding some semblance of a normal life and new and real new purpose, you know. And I think that's the hardest thing for a lot of veterans when they get out, is just the finding the new sense of purpose. And people think, you know, that new sense of purpose is just going and finding a good paying job. You know, I know guys who get out and they go work for, you know, government contract positions like Raytheon or Halliburton or something like that, and they're starting out at, you know, 100 or 150K or even sometimes even more. And then they quickly realize that, yeah, they're making really good money and their bills are paid, but they don't really feel that same sense of purpose that they had when they were in the military. They're just making money and supporting their families. And I think that's why we see a lot of guys who kind of find themselves in these moments of severe depression outside of just the PTSD diagnoses that they get, you know. And I think the depression is probably more prevalent and more important to look at than just PTSD by itself, because, you know, we have guys who, they lose their purpose, they lose their sense of accomplishment, they don't get that same experience in a civilian job most of the time that they got when they were in the military, and so they just feel lost. I know that was my biggest problem, was for years I bounced from job to job to job. I've had some jobs over the years that I did really enjoy, and probably one of the jobs that I enjoyed the most was working with at-risk, or not at-risk youth, but youth that actually had, you know, had criminal records and committed crimes, both criminally and sexually. And we worked with them in a house where we helped rehabilitate them and work with them to help them build healthy skills for being a part of society and things like that. And that was probably one of the single best jobs I had after I got out. And I had that job about 3 or 4 years after I got out of the military. The only problem was it just was not a very good paying job. And so I was struggling with keeping my bills paid. But that was the job. That job actually was the job that inspired me to stop pursuing these other degrees that I was trying to pursue and directly pursue psychology and look into becoming and getting into therapy or something of some kind to work with veterans and at-risk youth and stuff like that at the time. So the only problem was I had a very poor GPA at the time. That's something else a lot of veterans typically struggle with, is going to school. They have a hard time dealing with schools and getting good grades. I certainly was in that same boat. And I ended up flunking out of college the last time around at a 1.17 GPA. And I got a random opportunity to come back to college back in 2023 through the VA, through the Veterans Readiness and Employment Program. And I was able to go back to school and finish my degree. And that was when I decided to do computer science and psychology as a dual major because of a program they had at MSU that allowed me to dual major in those two. I was able to justify that to my VR&E counselor. And I lasted a year in the computer science program. And I quickly realized that I was not cut out for computer science. I thought, because I had kind of an analytically driven mind, that computer science would be a good route for me and a lucrative route, be able to work remote most of the time. But I do not understand programming very well. I tried very hard. I went through several tutors and just realized I couldn't get it. Well, it was that summer in 2024 that we went to my my friend Brian Housel's retirement, and we came back, and I remember having a conversation with my wife, and I was like, what if I just drop computer science and I just do psychology and I try to get into the mental health therapy program at MSU, and I just want to work with vets. I just want to help veterans. That's all I really want to do in life, is help them be successful, help them, you know, learn how to cope with and deal with the things they experienced, and try and heal some of the damage that's been done. And she goes, I'm surprised you haven't made that decision yet. She's like, that's exactly what you should be doing. And so I went and had a conversation with my advisors and dropped computer science and just went to psychology. And that's what I've been ever since. And that's what's leading up to culminating this chapter in May. On May 8th, I'll graduate with my Bachelor of Science in Psychology. And hopefully we'll get into the mental health therapy program at MSU. If not, I will be looking to go back to work for the remainder of the year, and then I will apply to the psychological sciences doctoral program in the fall if things go that direction.
That's such a good plan, and I just want to insert here that from the Veterans Health Administration, in 2023, the last report, 31% of VHA service users had a confirmed mental health diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, or schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder, and or substance disuse disorder, sometimes several of these. So what you're looking at is a huge need, and hopefully you will get into either one of these programs, because we really, truly need mental health professionals. From the Milbank Quarterly Multidisciplinary Journal on Population Health, they said 1 in 5 adults in America and youth ages 9 years old and older, and 1 in 6 children 2 to 8 years old experience mental illness each year. And about half of the U.S. population will experience a mental illness difficulty at some point in their lifetime. So there's a huge need. And coming from the National Council for Mental Well-Being, as of September 25th, 2025, more than 122 million Americans live in mental health professional shortage areas. There'll be a shortage there, a projecting of 88,000 mental health counselors and 114,000 addiction counselors coming right up here. So what we're seeing, and it's like you said, I read up on this, that many are struggling to be a mental health care provider because the pay is so low for counselors. And sort of like teachers, there needs to be a real adjustment here for how we set our priorities.
Absolutely, 100%. And so it's funny that you bring up those statistics, because obviously 100% spot on. One of the things I've been learning, so every opportunity that I've had to write a paper on research in any of my classes that I've had, I have specifically found a way to gear it towards veterans' mental health outcomes and PTSD research. Because I wanted to hone in on like what exactly is like my capstone thesis gonna be. And if I'm just picking randomly like fun subjects to write about in all these different classes, I'm not gonna really get anywhere. And so this culminated last fall term that we just completed, where I wrote a paper for my physiological psychology class, where I discovered some studies where they found, they've done measurements of like the hippocampus and the amygdala, and they found these, you know, physiological changes in the brain. Now there are a few really good texts to read For anybody listening out there, that I would highly recommend, especially if you're a veteran or if you're somebody who even helps veterans, I recommend reading these books. Operator Syndrome by Dr. Christopher Free is a phenomenal book that will make you rethink the way that we look at the framework of how veterans are treated from just that general healthcare perspective, especially in mental health. And then there's another book called Warrior Syndrome by Dr. T.M. Johnson, who was a medical doctor. He was actually a naval doctor while I was in the Marine Corps. And I've actually met him many, many, many years ago. Well, when he got out and became a civilian doctor, he wrote the book Warrior Syndrome. And that Warrior Syndrome book talks about the physiological impacts of trauma on the human brain and on the human body. And I also came across some other studies myself where they measured the volumetric differences between an unhealthy brain in people diagnosed with PTSD and bipolar disorder, I believe it was. And what they found was that there is a change in, or they've noticed that there is a difference in volumetric size in these subjects. And the problem that we ran into, and I went over all this research with one of my professors because I was struggling with connecting the dots on how I was gonna tie this into my paper. And he said that, well, what we see in this paper is a correlational problem. And I was like, okay, well, what do you mean by that? And he's like, well, think about it this way. He said, they are measuring these brains in these subjects that have already been met the diagnostic criteria and are diagnosed with these conditions, right? And I said, yes. He goes, so how do we know that the development of those conditions caused the volumetric changes in the brain? He said, and not a genetic predisposition or an existing volumetric change in the brain that increased their risk for developing these conditions. And I was like, it was kind of this aha moment for me where I was like, oh, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And so that became my discussion point in my research paper, my physiological psychology paper, where I talked about the fear response in the brain and the amygdala, or the relationship to the amygdala and how that relates to people with PTSD, especially, you know, combat exposure and veterans and things like that. And so my senior capstone is actually a project proposal on doing a longitudinal study on individuals that are joining the military and doing MRI scans, doing mental health batteries, false memory paradigm testing, and resiliency scale testing. You set baseline procedures so that we can test them before they go to boot camp or basic training, test them immediately after graduation from boot camp or basic training, and then every year annually we will retest them with those same batteries. And what we can do is after 4 to maybe 10 or 12 years of this longitudinal study, we would be able to hopefully determine what's actually causing the volumetric changes in the brain. Because there's a lot of evidence that indicates that the development of PTSD causes that change in the brain. But if you take into consideration that two people can experience the exact same traumatic event together, and one might develop PTSD and one might not develop PTSD, that indicates that there's also a genetic factor. And we do know that there are genetic factors to extreme stress. And so another one of the studies I came across, or not studies, this was actually talked about in my psychology of aging class, is telomeres in the chromosomes, in our DNA. And so telomeres are these little protective coatings that are on the ends of our chromosomes in our DNA. And the release of cortisol in the experience of high stressful environments causes those telomeres to wear out. Well, those telomeres have a finite lifespan. They don't just regenerate themselves. They wear out, and after a certain time, they will wear out completely. And once that happens, it can increase the likelihood of genetic mutations, and those genetic mutations and shortened lifespan can then be passed down genetically to your offspring. And so that
has
huge implications for the research in PTSD.
Justin,
and so, yeah.
Before we end today. We have about 3 minutes. I'm going to read a formal definition of PTSD for maybe some of those out there who don't know what it is, and you described it extremely well. I'll do this rather quickly. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a mental health condition triggered by experiencing or witnessing terrifying, violent, or life-threatening events such as accidents, abuse, or combat. Symptoms including flashbacks, nightmares, severe anxiety, and avoidance of reminders often last for months or years, significantly disrupting daily life. And the key aspects, exposure to traumatic events like natural disasters, assault, war, or serious accidents. There are four categories of core symptoms. One is re-experiencing flashbacks, nightmares, and scary thoughts. The second is avoidance, steering clear of places, people, or thoughts connected to the trauma. Third is cognition, mood changes, negative thoughts, emotional numbness, guilt, or memory problems. Fourth, arousal reactivity, being easily startled, feeling on edge, we call it hypervigilance, or difficulty sleeping. Then there's duration. Symptoms must last for more than 1 month to be diagnosed as PTSD. And lastly, the treatment. There are various treatments and medications, and you're getting into some of those.
I just want to say, too, I remember one elderly veteran explained that after having gone to Vietnam, he couldn't ever take a life again. He explained he couldn't even step on a bug. His phrase, which I've adapted as part of my life plan, "We're all just trying to make a living." He included every creature in that, every living thing. And so what you're talking about, Josh, is very elemental. And we really thank you for upping the game to researching more about this, which could ultimately be very helpful, and situating yourself to be a golden help for the veterans like this little gentleman who just is trying to make a living.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you guys having me on. And one, if I may, I just want to throw one last little thing out there. You know, all of this has culminated into us, myself and my colleagues, building a new nonprofit here in Bozeman called Warriors Azimuth. I won't go into the depth of detail of what we're going to do since I know we're out of time here, but I just want to say for your listeners and for you guys, keep your eyes open for that. I will definitely keep you guys in the loop as we get more and more developed and get ready to start actually helping veterans. But a lot of these problems that, like we've discussed today, everything from jobs to PTSD to success and academic outcomes, we're looking to try to, our life mission is to try and fix those problems. And I mean permanently fix those problems for veterans, so that veterans have better life outcomes after they get out of the military. So that's what we're working on right now.
Can one get onto a website and see that, Warriors?
That's the thing. So we just got started. We just got our EIN. We are actually putting together our funding pitch for investors and philanthropists and donors who want to donate to us. I'm waiting to finish submitting our tax exempt application so that we can launch into our first fundraiser. There we go. Geez.
Yeah.
Fundraiser. So we don't have a website yet. We are currently trying to work on getting our social media built so we can at least start putting things out there. Once I get all of that established, and we'll hopefully have that done in the next month, I will be happy to reach back out to you guys and give you guys the links for all of that on Facebook so you guys can disseminate that to other listeners and things like that. But the name of the organization is Warriors Azimuth, AZIMUTH.
Okay.
Got it. That's so great. We'll look forward to hearing more.
Josh, we thank you so much, and we thank the audience for listening. If you have a mental health emergency, you can always, for one thing, call 988, especially for veterans. And there are local centers like the Help Center, 411 or 211. And we hope to have you on our program again, Josh. Thank you.
I look forward to it. Thank you guys so much for your time today. I had a good time, and I look forward to talking with you guys again soon.
Thank you.